So welcome, everyone. Welcome. So I felt tonight a little bit of uplift, a little bit of excitement in the air as we get close to our journey into a new Dharma center. And I look forward to it. I went up to one person and just thanked them for their contribution. And he said to me, "Well, you know, it's my Dharma center too." I love that. All of us own this thing, and there's a beautiful spirit about that. We've been nomadic for the last 25 years, and now we're going to have a place. And there's a feeling of rootedness that comes, belonging. I'm going to speak about belonging the first evening that we get together. But I just want to thrive and have all of us thrive within this sense of ownership, which is so beautiful. Although it has nothing to do with what I want to speak about tonight. I want to start off. I was in Barre, Massachusetts. I'm a guiding teacher there, and because I'm a guiding teacher, I also sit on the board. And the guiding teachers are the sort of the lead teachers of the center, Joseph and Sharon and people like that. So there were seven of us sitting around, and we were talking about the influence of mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR as it's known in the field, and how it's bringing in many more people into meditation than Buddhism. It's secular mindfulness, and we were relishing the fact that that was occurring. We also realized that very few of those people would have ever come through the Buddhist door, because it just holds a tradition in which there's an unfamiliarity and perhaps an awkwardness, or like, why do I need another religion kind of point of view. And so we were talking about that value, but at the same time we were also acknowledging that Buddhism holds something that MBSR does not. And that's the depth of the Dharma, the transformation. As I understand much of how mindfulness-based stress reduction is taught, it's taught medicinally, one might say. That is sort of is something you apply when you have a particular problem that you want to address, that you want to understand a little more, whether it be your stress reduction or cognitive impairments. But then you put the ointment down when you've reached a satisfactory level of ease with that particular difficulty, and pick it up again supposedly when something else arises. Well, that leaves a very full medicine chest. But it's not the way of transformation. Now, I'm not suggesting that you can't practice these two things simultaneously. You can. But let's never forget why we meet here. We meet here not for the ointments of the day, the remedies of the day, to balance our blood pressures and slow our heart rate, although that's perfectly appropriate and also healthy to do. We meet this for an evolution of spirit, for transformation. And some of us get a little reluctant to move in that direction. Perhaps it's pushing us a little further than we had initially wanted to go. Or it's asking something from us that we're afraid to offer. Or it's showing us something about ourselves that is so rich and deep and magical that we can scarcely believe that we contain it. In fact, we try everything we can to pretend otherwise, to keep ourselves within, under the influence and veil of our misperception. And so we meet here strengthening an intentionality that all of us need to do to move forward, to inch forward within that transformative process. It does not mean that we do not use Buddhism to also help us with our stress and to lower our blood pressure. Those are byproducts. And in the many suttas, they give some 240 byproducts of meditation. You can find that on the market, within the marketplace. But this is the reason we come. We come for the depth, for the stillness that is intrinsic. We come to nudge ourselves forward. To allow ourselves to offer our heart upon the table. And that is why I call this series The Birthing of the Heart. For each of these talks are meant to address a particular conscribed way that we protect ourselves from the full valor, the full awakening, the full transformation. Tonight, I wish to speak about resolve. I call resolve the warrior's heart, but for the women among us, it's gender neutral. And I don't mean it to be a masculine trait, and I hope you'll see that as we get familiar with this term. But it's an archetypical warrior. It's a warrior of the spirit. And even as I'm speaking about it, I'm calling it forth, which is very interesting because I can feel it rising. And each of us have that ability to call the deepest level of ourselves forward in all of the archetypical ways. And sometimes it's very helpful to call upon something in us when we don't feel like the small me of me has the ability to address what I confront or what's in front of me. And when we call the warrior forward, we call a kind of determination. A determination and resolve that lives at the edge of its own wisdom. That has the confidence through repeated attempts to live on that edge. It knows what is possible living from that edge. But like all things in which there is a training, this quality of determination doesn't start out with that wisdom or that confidence or that assurance. It starts out looking like discipline, like just getting yourself in the early stages of our training to the zafu, to the pillow, sometime during the course of the day, and sitting there, thinking nothing is going on, nothing is happening, this is a waste of time. But sitting there, even at that level, there is something happening, something that's some depth that is being evoked. Because why would you sit there when everything that makes sense to you tells you to get up? It makes no sense at all to sit here. Except that we do. And some of us do repeatedly over a long period of time. You see, what we're evoking, what we're calling forth, that transformation, is a new life. Not just a modification of the old life. Not just how to live more comfortably with all my thinking and to adapt sufficiently to my emotional life. Not that. Although I am not negating that as having value. But that's not why we're sitting. There's something that's being called up from us, from the depths of us. From the depths of our own wonder. And that discipline is the start, is the beginning, is the first crank in one of those old automobiles and that needed many cranks before the engine began. It's the first turn of something in us that is vast and mysterious and that we sense is there. But when we try to confirm it being there, it seems to become invisible to our eyes, to our proof. It's hard for other people to see. They sense a change, but you're just getting nicer. Just not quite as argumentative. Even that may take years. It's something other than that. It's something other than the 240 byproducts. It's a transformation. And for some people, it's interesting, there's a couple of character types that take discipline to extremes. One of those are people who have a lot of self-hatred and are trying to smother themselves with something that they are not sure what it is, but that meditation may be a way to smother themselves out of existence so that they don't have to deal with themselves any longer. And for those, that character type, they become doggedly determined. But there's another character type that I often sense in beginning classes. Every once in a while I'll look up from the meditation and I'll see somebody sitting. And I know they haven't been sitting long. They're in a beginning meditation class. But there's some sense of them well-placed and at home and belonging to themselves in meditation. A sense that this is a timeless adventure for them. And that they have repeated this perhaps for many lifetimes. And for them, for those who are given or have a sense, they're often driven early on with that sort of determination, but zeal, where they know they're not where they used to be at some other point in their long ago history. And they don't know what it is that they are missing, but they know they're missing something. And they're running on that sense of the potential, but not sure of what it is that they're running towards. And so it comes out as a very forceful will. And a kind of, at the same time, stubbornness, for lack of a better word, where they just aren't going to, they aren't listening to people about how to self-correct that dogged determination. You say to relax, and they pass the yes, I hear that, but I'm going for it anyway. And it's sort of this, you know, all cylinders. I can't tell you which character type I was or am, but I do know that I spent weekends early on in my practice closed up in a closet, not allowing myself to come out unless I had bathroom needs. Senseless and useless, but no one could tell me that. There was just something that I had to break through. And so we've heard discipline, which is a very important quality within the practice. We've heard determination, which has its own rigor and strength and focus. We've heard stubbornness, which won't listen to anyone, and just is going to do it in his or her own way. And now I'd like to bring a fourth word in, which is resolve, steadfastness. Because usually we will have run through one or all of the earlier qualities of stubbornness, determination, and discipline before we come to steadfastness. Steadfastness is best shown through an example, and I'll use the Buddha as an example. So he spent 6 years as an ascetic monk trying to drive himself beyond his body. Or I don't really understand the practices of eating one grain of rice a day and, you know, just being emaciated and starved and all of that. But anyway, after 6 years of that kind of self-brutality, he shakes his head and says, this just hasn't been working. Now, first of all, he was honest enough to go against 6 years of commitment, you see? And I like these stories metaphorically more than as an actual truth of the story. I don't really know about that. But metaphorically, what he's doing is saying, you know, my life hasn't been working. And I would like to suggest for each of us to ask that question and be willing to live with the answer. Has our life been working? I mean, it works sometimes, and then it doesn't work. But I want to know if it works continuously, despite what's in front of us as obstructions. And then the Buddha sits down and he says, you know what? Not in anger, not in belligerence, not in intolerance or inflexibly, but with extraordinary patience, I think, because that's what steadfastness is. He says, you know what? I'm not going to get up. I just don't have any reason to get up. I don't have any reason to continue to live the way I've been living. And so I'm going to sit here until I know of a new way to live, until I have been transformed. I really believe if it had pushed him, he would have just died. He was that far at the end of what he thought he could do with his life, within his life. He'd been everything. He'd been a prince. He'd been a warrior. He was from the warrior class. And now he was bringing that warrior spirit to bear upon his spiritual pursuit. So I'm just not going to get up. But it wasn't with a sense of resignation or depression. There was an alive energy there. He was on the crest, on the edge of his own knowledge. And he realized that going back had no place in his life whatsoever. And it was at that moment, I believe, although it's not written as such, that he was fully awakened. When there was that level of resolve, I can't keep going. It just isn't working. It's not an argument. It's like there's nowhere else to go. There's nothing else to do. And so he sits down, but when he sits down within that resolve, it is so unparalleled. The intention is so absolute. It is so complete. It is so aligned in spirit that the door towards transformation is opened. And then the rest is history. I worked with a physician, a hospice doc, who in those days actually made home visits to the hospice patients on admission. He was also a meditation student. And he came back to the office after one visit, and he was noticeably different. Wasn't shaken. He felt something had happened. Sometimes you can sense that. And I asked him, I said, what's going on? What happened? And he said, well, let me tell you what happened. He said he had a patient sitting across from him that he was admitting to the hospice program. And the patient was sitting on the couch, and he had the patient sit up. And he was sitting right there on the couch facing the patient who was sitting up. And perhaps, I'm not sure whether he was listening to his lungs or with a stethoscope. And as he was doing so, he was looking into the patient's eyes. And as he was reading the vital signs, the patient died staring at him. And he said it took him into death itself. It drew energetically, it drew him in. And he says, I just have a different sense of what death is now, a kind of a confidence or a an assurance. And from that day on, although he never showed much trepidation in terms of the subject, I saw none. I never saw any wavering. And he didn't speak about it much. In fact, he didn't speak about it again to me ever. But there was an alteration. Now, you could say he was fortunate. But each of us, when we sit down in our meditation, if we do it with that resolution of heart, with that spirit of intention, we can go through ourselves. We can see all the way back. All the way back to the beginning. Because it's always beginning anew. And therefore the opportunity to see the beginning is forever. And all we have to do is to catch that glance. Just momentarily. And something profound accesses us. And we walk with it from then on. This is the resolve. This is the love of truth. Because the resolve is nothing. You see, it's the heart that says, no, I can't keep going. I just can't keep going. I can't keep this modification, this half-hearted attempt going. I just can't do it. It's been decades. I wake up every morning and the day meets me in exactly the same way. Where is this transformation? You see, there's not, it's not a panic need, but it's a passionate need. Where is this transformation? My God, I've done everything. I don't know how many retreats I have under my belt. I don't know how long I've been practicing and how responsibly I've been following the homeworks. But this calls for something else, you see. See, what happens when we say no more? What comes out of us when we say no more? And we mean no more. I mean, we all say, I'm not doing this anymore. But when we mean it, no more. That's a change of life. That's a change in location. The no more is the ending of the perpetuation of sameness. It's not a rejection of our life. It's a surrender to our life. I'm not going to try to make this thing pretty. I'm not going to try to beautify it. I'm not going to try to relish in it. I'm not going to try to gain something out of it. All of it is futile. It doesn't go anywhere. It's not lasting. It's not satisfactory. No more. That must have been what the Buddha mythologically have come to. No more. Through the love of truth, I'm not going to deceive myself any longer. There's a quote by Lincoln, which I really love. He says, I have been driven many times to my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I have nowhere else to go. $700,000 dead. Riding through the battlefields of the Civil War. Who do you turn to? You see, I have nowhere. So what he does is he just falls to his knees. He just surrenders his life to something over to something else. So the first quality of resolution is holding one's ground. Not tenaciously, not in combat, not that style of the warrior, but so open, so flexible, so available, that it no longer touches life in terms of a contrast or resistance or a point of pressure. Life then moves through within the steadfastness. And the mind, many times I have given homework assignments to this point where we pick a particular emotion or something that is constantly troubling to us, that we find ourselves acting from again and again. And you simply say, okay, no more. I could have written journals, volumes and volumes of journals around this one quality of mind and my reactive expression to it. And now, that's it. No more. And then the state of mind comes in, but is not desecrated with our identification. Like the sky, the mind opens like the sky, and then it just, like the sky that holds all things, it also holds this particular state of mind. But get a sense as I'm speaking at how nuanced the awareness needs to be, not to loop back into that state of mind within the story the state of mind continually creates. Just get a sense of that. Take your state of mind, the one that you've lived with and forever has dragged you down. And as it begins to occur, as it begins to happen, there's a whole disposition we have to it. Physical, mental disposition that already the words are having us live the narrowness and the confines and the details. And then we get more entrapped within the alluring moods and the depiction and the historical reference and all the reasons and all the ways I've, and all, and. Now, bring this no more spirit to that same state of mind. The sky does not falter. It does not lean in. It does not contract around. It doesn't lose its spaciousness. And now that state of mind can move effortlessly through. And there is absolutely no resistance. Mara, it said, if there is any clinging, Mara will track you down. The sky clings not. But if we are to believe a single word of the descriptive quality of that mood, Mara has us in its target. And then, because there is nothing, there is no position I am taking in relationship to that, there's no positionality I'm taking in relationship to anything. And without a positionality in relationship to anything, then all things move. There's a total exposure to all things hidden within me. It's remarkable to me that we can know these things exist within us and not be willing to see them. As if we could, or little children, and if we just close our eyes tightly enough, we can pretend they're not there. But they are there. And so opening our eyes allows that to be acknowledged. And it also offsets the resistance that keeps us within and embedded within its issue. That, if there's a must-see point, it's that one. Aren't there times in your practice that you'd like to stand in front of the mirror and just rip your chest open and just say, bear witness. I don't care what's in here. I just bear witness. That's the warrior spirit. I don't want any more unconscious me. I don't want to hide anymore. If this is transformation, it's got to be all transformed. It can't be what I like being transformed or what I don't like being transformed. That's what resolve looks like. And why is it so difficult? Because it feels too vulnerable. We feel too exposed, without protection. But that's just another feeling. It's with a very strong story behind it, because we think that everybody will see us as we see ourselves. And once I expose myself, I expose you to how you, I see myself. And it's the way I see myself is so awful that I know it will be awful in your eyes as well. Too vulnerable, or we're too complacent. This is the second. So we're just, it's like, you know, I kind of like it the way I am. I kind of like it the way I haven't reached no more. And I show up for Tuesday nights, or I come to a retreat once a year. I'm pretty much the rest of my life is kind of an acknowledgement of trying to be as aware as I can and faltering many times. But, you know, it's just kind of... But there's no vitality. There's no passion to that search. There's no zest. Chandra in Pali. Zeal. Which means we are far away from the source of aliveness itself. Because as we get closer to the source of aliveness, that's what we feel. We feel a rising of that zest, of that zeal, of that joy, of that anticipated love. And then there's the fear of isolation. This is an interesting one. Why is it interesting? Because I just read an article in the Boston Globe about this particular. I've got to share this. Boston Globe, this was when I was coming back from, so it was on Friday. Boston Globe study that showed in the rush of everyday life, many people say they crave a moment of solitude, right? If you ask somebody, would you like a moment of solitude? Oh, I'd love a moment of solitude, okay? But a startling new study finds that people don't really enjoy spending any, even 10 minutes alone with their thoughts. In fact, the researchers found, to their own musing, that thoughts, that a person's thoughts were so unsatisfactory in research done by the University of Virginia that many people chose to administer painful electric shocks to themselves rather than sit in quiet contemplation. One of the subjects shocked himself 150 times in 10 minutes. In other words, sitting alone with one's thoughts and the feeling of the isolation of that was worse than the stimulation that electric shock, a painful jolt, would offer. At least a painful jolt acknowledged that I was alive and doing something. Now, all this stuff begins to make sense, doesn't it? Please, not time alone. Isn't that amazing? But before we're too amazed, I always like to bring it back home. Do we really enjoy being by ourselves? What do we do to fill that space when we are alone? How crowded do we like the sounds and smells and tastes around us so that we aren't in isolation with ourselves? And then the next reason that many of us can't quite reach the no more spirit is because we're afraid if we do surrender our resistance to life, we're not sure what we'll become. In fact, historically, we might have been familiar with Freud and a robust id where there lurks the shadow of our terror. And if I drop my guard, doesn't the id need the superego? Doesn't it need some protection? Doesn't it need me to be forever putting my qualities and states of mind at arm length so that I can deal with life? What if I drop that guard? What would rush in? What would I become? The worst part of me might show up. Which is interesting because it's the best part of us that shows up in non-resistance. Where do we think the heart comes from? Where do we think it, where the spirit of the heart lives? It's time to trash Freud. and to give this thing a new start. We're so afraid of the evil that lurks inside that we don't see any basic goodness there. But if we're not resistant to that force of terror and rage, then it has no way to gain any foothold. And the definition of love is living without a foothold. And some of us aren't finished with the moods and the emotions that we so love to be within. Many times I was appalled by feeling some mood in me and being aware and sensitive enough to see myself go with the mood rather than the awareness, because I could get some juice out of the mood. I could justify my life. It made sense from the mood. Even though if it made a darkened sense, it still made sense in some way that living in a complete open way doesn't. It gave me traction. It gave me a reason for being. Often a suffering reason for being, but in many cases, I took it. Within my practice history. And it's just, you just watch yourself go with the mood. And you go, I can't believe what I just did. And so we have in front of us different levels of commitment. We have the level of commitment of discipline, which just gets us there to the cushion and has us sit, which is good. And then we have the level of commitment of determination, where we sense that there's more of a robust passion for what we're doing than just doing it every day regardless. And then there is the arising of even of a dogged determination. Something in a sense is we're going somewhere, but we have no idea where we're going, but we have to go and we're not about to listen. And that judgmental stubbornness, actually, when it moves in spiritual alignment, becomes self-reliance. Where it says, I'm not going to trust anyone else's wisdom. I'm going to see if he's right or she's right on my own. I'm going to see for myself. And so this sense of stubbornness flips and no longer is it rigid resistance, but simply a committed presence. And then there is steadfastness. Where there's just the wisdom seeing that I can't keep going forward and I can't turn around and I can't go left and I can't go right. And so I just drop it. It occurred to me one time when I was watching Godzilla movie and Godzilla was going through New York or some such creature, I can't quite remember. And he was, you know, saliva coming down, and he was knocking over buildings and trampling over people. And everybody was in a panic and rushing out of New York. And I thought, you know, if I was in that crowd, I'd turn back and say, come on, I'm tired of running. I'm not going to live like that. That's it. Stomp on me if you wish. It isn't worth living if I have to live in terror of you. That's it. I love that. And so may it be for all of us. Can we just sit for a minute or two? See if you can find the steadfast presence. It's not inflexible. But it's steadfast. It doesn't move. Everything moves through it, but it doesn't move. So it's steadfast, not in the sense of a rigidity, but in terms of total accommodation, because it's wide open and it doesn't move. That is the seat of the warrior. So if there are any questions or comments, no, I'm talking about adhidhan. That's the Pali word for resolve. It's a different parami. It is a parami. So is energy. But it has a different way of manifesting. It's manifestation. I mean, all of the paramis are just perceptions on awareness. Okay? So if you look at awareness from this way, it looks energetic. If you look at it from this way, it looks patient. If you look at it in terms of action, it looks generous. If you look at it in terms of its settledness, it looks steadfast. You can't jar it, right? It doesn't flinch. Okay, so that's the aspect of awareness that I was addressing tonight, the non-flinching aspect.
I noticed that Joseph Goldstein translated that particular part of the one that Lindahl talked about as diligence, and that seems to have some of the same qualities you were talking about. Is that correct?
Diligence feels a little too mentally driven for me, but it's just my, you listen to whoever you listen to has their own definition. I just can't think of a better word for me than steadfast. And none of them, all of them also have mental tones to them, because when you say steadfast, you go, I know what that is. But that's what the mind knows it to be. But if something is unwavering, but open, and totally accommodating, it sounds like it's a paradox, doesn't it? So there's a new life there, not the old one, not the mental life of how I know steadfast to be, but something else. So I can just get a sense of it. It's best not to take definitions that somebody gives to awareness and then try to live them out mentally, because what you'll do is have a cheap replica of the real thing. You have the mental replica, an imposter. Rather, you think, oh, that's interesting. What does it mean to be open, unwavering, and not moving? What does that mean? I'm not going to try to figure it out mentally. I'm not going to try to create it mentally. I'm going to use it as an exploration of my own heart to see where it takes me. What is that? What could that possibly be? It's like a koan. How can that be? And you don't try to mentally try to figure it out. You just give it over to the sense of being unsettled with it, but not trying to analyze it or create an answer to it. You just, okay, let me just see what that is. And more often than not, depending upon our persistence within that exploration, something will arise that will show you the very thing. The koan will be answered. You know, I can't hear you, dear.
I get angry kind of around the...
You get angry?
With that I'm even thinking, that I have a pattern, or I have that object.
Right.
And how do you... And when I have the, when I hear the word resolve or determination...
Right.
Or being calm, I want to kind of...
Right.
I want to do it, and I start right. Hating myself, and then I'm in this weird...
Right. At the point where you have a you have a reaction pattern, and then you have a reaction to the reaction pattern... You see, you're dividing yourself into two people. The person that has the reaction, and then the person that's having an anger reaction to the reactive pattern, right? It's better not to keep dividing, right? Okay, so let's consolidate this picture, not divide out. So one reaction is plenty. Let's not react to the reaction, okay? Usually what you're doing is taking the reaction and turning it back on itself. So, like, I'm annoyed and I'm angry that I'm annoyed. Well, anger is a form of annoyance, so I'm just putting wood on the fire, right? So that's one way to look at it. The other is that you just keep fracturing different parts of yourself all over the place. And this is really, if you're doing that, think, okay, now, this is about interconnectedness, not about fracturing, not about making myself more... into more pieces, but bringing and unifying all those pieces. So let me just be quiet with what's going on. You see? Now, when you're not speaking, when you're not responding negatively to it, what is there now? Now I'm no longer angry at it. And I'm seeing it, because when I was angry at it, I wasn't seeing it. I just wanted to get it out of my sight, right? Just move on. Now I'm not angry at it. I'm just being quiet with it. I have to really be quiet with it, not just bite my lip, but just now when I'm really quiet with it, what opens in that quietude is awareness. Okay, now here's the key. The byproduct of awareness of something is understanding. That's a byproduct. All I have to do is pay attention to something, and wisdom is accrued. And when I begin to understand what something is, then there is a sense of unification with it, as opposed to the opposite of creating more pieces and more reactions to it. Now I'm moving in a wise direction. And that's a key to me. I now judge the way my practice is moving as if the fewer the pieces, the better. The more connection or interconnectedness, the better. Right? So I'm going to limit the number of pieces. And I'll do whatever practices I can do that does just that. Get a sense? Great, good.
Getting back to the no more part, I have trouble imagining how I could say no more. You know, no more telling myself stories. No more bad habits.
That's a wish list. That's not no more. That's like a resolution. That's like a New Year's resolution. New Year's resolution is no more. Is not what I'm talking about. Okay? It's not like, okay, from now on, no more tantrums. Damn it. You see? When you do that, you split yourself up again. There's a part of you that concedes the tantrum and part of you that resists the tantrum. Okay, that's too many. Okay, you don't want to do that, really. If there are more voices, if you're creating more voices in you that are coming after the object or the mind state, then you've created that many extra pieces that you have to work with. Let's simplify this down. What is this? What's wrong with me the way I am? That's a beautiful way to start. Well, I have, you know, this, and I have that. Okay, just be quiet for a second. Just let's not make yourself a problem. Okay, let's just now meet your life with quiet and see what comes out from there, rather than from your guard up and shadow box your way through it. Okay, let me just meet life quietly. And then if something comes up that's truly a problem, I'll address it. But I'll address it from a different disposition than I normally would, which is to take medications or, I don't know, whatever, go to a therapist, I don't know. See, it's just like, let me just go the other way on this. But sense it in the room. Oftentimes, because people's consciousness are moving in the direction of unification through a Dharma talk or through meditation, you can sense the silence in the room. And that can give your practice an uplift. So you just then there may be some dispute, like, oh, I'm like the list of four or five problems I have with being quiet, right? I'm too exposed, somebody will see me, you know, I'm not defined enough. I mean, there are endless number of reasons that we refuse to be quiet. Let me give myself electric shock instead of being quiet. You know, they're like, but what about this? I'd go there. In fact, when the Buddha was moving into his no more, he remembered a scene of his youth in which his father was plowing the fields in some ceremonial. His father was a king, so he was doing some ceremonial plowing of the fields at some holiday or something. And the Buddha remembers sitting in rapt stillness. And he says, I remember that. And all of these intervening years, that's what I'm going to move towards. That's the direction I'm inclining my mind towards. Okay, we have to leave it for this evening and have some announcements. Thank you for your attention.